Hello, business owners, entrepreneurs, and executives. Welcome to today's Business Radio, a new hybrid radio show that airs both on air as well as online and on demand. We discuss all the topics relating to your business. Today's Business Radio interviews experienced business advisors to help you build enterprise value, improve profitability, and plan for your eventual exit. Whether you're an entrepreneur just starting out, a seasoned business owner, or a top-level executive, today's Business Radio will help you achieve your personal and professional goals. Today's Business Radio is available around the clock, around the world, online, and on demand at todaysbusinessradio.com. Now, the host of today's Business Radio, Tom Lyons.
Hello, this is Tom Lyons, and I'm here with my co-host, Sam Zordich. Our guest today is John Cameron from the Cameron Law Offices. They deal in business transactions, real estate deals, and commercial, I can't ever say that, John, commercial litigation. I should be able to say that one. And, John, today our topic is going to be Ponzi schemes. This is a current topic in the news, and I suppose a lot of people are like me, what in the heck is a Ponzi scheme, and where did that name come from?
Well, Tom, first let me tell you, if you don't ever have to say commercial litigation, you're probably better off.
That's a good thing, isn't it? No commercial litigation. I can't even say enough.
What I like to tell clients is that, litigation is the most civilized dispute resolution process invented by man. You know, used to fight wars, used to have duels, but now we try to have litigation. But when you're involved in it, it's hard to convince you of that.
Sam, is that civilized if we have to hire two lawyers to fight and then we have to pay? I don't see anything civilized about that. But let's get back to Ponzi schemes.
Good preventative.
Yeah, let's not do that. Ponzi schemes, John.
Well, they've obviously become very well known in the press these days with some local things that have gone on with the allegations in the Petters case and, of course, the national and international, the Madoff case.
Oh, yeah.
This is something that in my practice that we've had experience with is going back as many as 10 and 15 years ago. And basically what it is, it's a concept where you take investors' money and you agree to pay a high rate of return, and the rate of return is typically paid by bringing in other investors. And eventually it falls apart because you can't keep enough money rolling in. And I think Warren Buffett just said recently, when the tide goes out, you see who's not wearing a bathing suit. And
there's a picture.
And that's what happens here. When recently the credit woes have come, there's less money to be attracted into these deals, or people are calling, trying to get their money out, and that's when the curtain is pulled apart, and you're able to look behind and see that there was nothing behind these things.
And then if there's some doubt for some reason, a lot of them start running and trying to pull their money, and then it's exposed, isn't it?
Right.
How is this different, like, from multi-level marketing or pyramid schemes? Or,
well, a pyramid scheme is identical to a Ponzi scheme. It's okay. You're bringing in more parties all the time. Multi-level marketing is sometimes, a corporation is really a pyramid scheme. You have somebody at the top and you have individuals below, but you have a legitimate business reason for structuring that. You're offering a service or a product into the market. You're in it for business. You're not there strictly to bring people in to get their resources to to create this facade of a legitimate business. So you'll see in multi-level marketing that it is structured on people underneath you. That I think that in their defense, what they would say is that they are offering a product, whether that is some household products or some other type of product. It's a marketing strategy. If they were only getting together for the purpose of bringing money in without some product or service being out, given out, then it would be more like a Ponzi or a pyramid scheme.
Okay.
So the Ponzi that you just talked about, it's just money. That's a deliberate scheme built like a pyramid where you're bringing in ever-increasing numbers of people to repay the people at the top, and at some point you just can't produce the numbers and it collapses of its own weight.
Right, and there is a fine line there because as businesses, we're all trying to create a larger client base and a larger revenue stream. However, it really goes to the intent of having a legitimate business purpose. Investment companies might lose money. However, they had a specific investment plan that they were going to put these resources to work. They could show you the plan. They could show you the trades. They could show you what they invested in. Might have lost all the money, but at least they could show that plan implemented. These individuals who put these together are really in the business of just collecting the dollars, using them potentially for their own use, using them to get more people to bring money in with no legitimate business plan or service or product underlying the business.
So it's really a deliberate ruse?
Correct.
Yeah, where are those resources?
Sure.
Yeah, where are they put?
Couldn't it also, John, be a legitimate business deal or real estate deal where it started out being a good deal and they ran into some kind of a wall or some kind of disaster or some kind of vacancy and the management decided, well, we can't fix this, but let's bring in some more investors and we'll make it look like we fixed it. It could be something like that that accidentally happened as well, couldn't it?
Well, I think that, at some point, that particular scenario started out as a legitimate business, and then when they went to that next step to bring in the money,
desperation.
It really in that scenario goes to maybe we wouldn't call it a Ponzi scheme, but we would really question what is required under the law, in which is a level of disclosure where the new individuals coming in had a real understanding of what was involved.
Well, there's disclosure that's necessary. And that's not in a Ponzi scheme. There's the allocation of resources,
right.
Not to the individual.
And then there's desperation and fraud, I guess. Those are the next two things. John, and we're talking about these Ponzi things that are in the press, and I think you were telling me a story about Alfonso Ponzi at one time, and we should probably finish that. But then I'm interested in finding out in your practice, when you're dealing with people investing in real estate and investing in business, what kind of schemes should they be looking out for, and how can you help them spot those so that they can determine the difference between that kind of thing and a legitimate investment?
Well, the first time I'd ever become aware of Mr. Ponzi was in the late 90s. And I had a client who was from overseas who had invested money he'd put a couple million dollars into what he thought was an investment. And upon investigating it further, there was always an excuse as to why he wasn't getting his return and why he couldn't get his money. And there was always, well, the investment is not going to close for another 90 days. So we started looking into this, and like I say, in the late 90s, and Mr. Ponzi was a gentleman who had immigrated to North America through Canada and then the United States. And he didn't invent this, but his name has been attached to it because he was one of the first really well-known ones to do this in the early 1900s, in about around 1910. And, in the first, he was promising if you left your money in for 45 days, I think it was, that he'd give you a 50% return on your money. And if you left it in 90 days, you'd be 100%. And over a period of months, he was able to attract millions of dollars in the first several months. Eventually, like all Ponzi schemes, it fell apart. He went to jail. People lost a lot of money.
Those that were in early actually made those kind of returns and maybe were used to help promote the deal to bring in new investors?
Sure. And what typically happens is that early on, money is paid out to the initial investors so that they'll go tell their friends about this great deal this great opportunity, and that they're getting their check every month. And then typically what happens is that people say, well, just send me part of the money, and then they leave them. They want to keep investing.
Yeah, that's it.
But what we learned in we had a number of these in the late 90s where we were working with clients, and there's usually a number of things that go on in these things where if an attorney looked at the documentation, they're documents that we're not familiar with. They're trying to create some new kind of trust or some kind of debenture or some, we don't understand it because it's something they do in Europe. There's always this part of it you can't quite get your arms around. Can't get your arms around the structure.
So it's doublespeak rather than legalese.
Right. And they can't answer things. And one of the difficult things in some of these is, we're very mobile society, and with the internet and wire transfers, give you an example, one of the issues we had here is our client was from overseas, yet they use the guise of Washington, D.C. as a great place to meet, the Watergate Hotel. They're going to have their summit there. These guys flew in from Europe. They lined them up with an attorney. We were not involved at that time, who set up some a business in the Cayman Islands for our client. Hmm. And then, of course, right when they were having a beautiful dinner, they said, you know what, we have a tranche closing tomorrow, and if you don't get in now, you may have to wait another 120 days to get in. Well, of course, the wire transfer, you know, get on the phone after we've had a nice dinner, and they end up, client ends up sending the money. Later, when he couldn't get it back, he contacted us, and we were involved, and we started doing what we normally do as part of our due diligence before someone puts the money in, and we discovered a number of things.
Mm. So one of the early signals was Watergate? let me say this about that.
Now, are you seeing the Ponzi schemes now in the same dollar amounts as you did when in the 90s?
Well, last January, I flew to Tallahassee, Florida, and testified in a criminal prosecution of one of these Ponzi schemes that had originated in the late 90s. And again, going back to the situation with the Watergate, everyone had come from an international place and came to Washington, D.C. to kind of consummate this thing. Well, what you have is all these border disputes, and in one of the ones we were involved with, they prosecuted everyone they could find in the United States, but then they had to extradite these individuals to the United States, one of which was an attorney that I had had a number of conversations with after my client had invested, trying to get the money back. And I was contacted by the United States Attorney General and was subpoenaed to Florida to testify about those conversations with that individual. He was an attorney that they had brought in extradited. It took him 7 years to bring him in from Canada. And at the conclusion of his trial last January, he was convicted and sent to jail. And he was the last person in that Ponzi scheme to go to jail. Now, this was something that took place in about 1997 or 98. And talking to the prosecutor, they believe that about $75 million was involved in that one. Now, with the current numbers we're seeing in some of the local papers, those numbers are rather minor. But at the time, it's hard to convince a client who maybe put $1 million or $2 in.
Still that's high.
Right.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true.
Well, what I tell clients is, you know, trust your gut. I mean, it's they all, you know, they don't. And one of the hard things is we had a client who was involved in a couple of these things. We were able to get some of his money back, and we were able to show him by doing the due diligence that we normally do on the front end. After that, these guys that he was talking to and were giving him a different excuse every day might not have been the most trustworthy people in the world, And, you know, in retrospect, they look at their instincts, and their instincts were telling them, yeah, it seemed too good to be true, and I kind of had some questions about those guys, but, you know, my buddy was in it, and he was getting his checks.
Well, that was the question I had. How do these people get introduced to something like this? How would I be introduced to someone that I would all of a sudden go, here, have $1 million?
Right. Well, and these people are very good at what they do. Their whole job is to you know, acquire someone's trust, to their salespeople. They do have, the story isn't all fabricated. They base it with a backdrop of, I think Madoff, in reading in the paper here, he was telling people he's doing trades at the, on the commodities floor. I think someone just testified before Congress that if he were, he would have had been executing more contracts than were even available. And second of all, they couldn't find anybody in the trading floor that had ever done a trade with them. So if you dig through these things, and I think the local case here, the Petters case, that is allegations of being a Ponzi scheme, there's people who are who've come forward who said that, you know, we did the due diligence and we saw things. We weren't sure it was a Ponzi scheme, but we elected not to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm a local investor, I've got a little extra cash, and I'm looking for a new deal, whether it's real estate or business or whatever it might be, and whether it's a real deal or a Ponzi deal, if I've got a deal coming up, it's probably a good idea to come over to talk to John Cameron and say, hey, John, I've got this deal. Here's the proposal. Here's the documents. Here's the paperwork. How can you tell the difference between a real deal and a Ponzi?
Well, first, let me say that, you know, as far as, you know, whether somebody will make money on a deal or not, I think it's very difficult for us to do that. However, it's easier, you know, people don't, they don't like to lose money in deals, but they feel better about if it was actually a legitimate deal that had a legitimate plan that maybe market forces didn't allow it to succeed.
Sure.
When we get involved with a client, you know, we've had clients who were approached by inventors. One example, in the again, around late 90s, early 2000, we had a client who was approached by an inventor who had claimed to be able to convert seawater to hydrogen for energy.
Nice.
Which can be done. It's done in high school chemistry classes all the time. However, it usually takes about three times as much energy to create the hydrogen as it is that you're going to create. The economics of it don't work well, but this guy had supposedly solved it. He had offered some credentials that said he had a PhD from a certain university that would support why he would be sophisticated at this. So our client, as part of our due diligence, asked us to not only look through the offering documents, but to do some due diligence on the individual. We were able to discover that the individual had never taken a class at that university, undergraduate or graduate, had never gotten a degree, a PhD from there. When we presented this to the client, again, overseas client, when I came in the next morning, there was a diploma from that university with this individual's name on it sitting in my fax machine. Well, of course, my heart sank, and I thought, oh, my God, what have I accused this individual of? But then we followed up with the university, and they said, well, send us the diploma.
Here we go.
We were able to determine from that conversation and their review of the diploma that first, that individual had never taken a class, undergraduate or graduate there, that the person who signed as the president of the university had never been the president of the university, and their diplomas had never looked like that.
What's going on here?
Little fantasy world this person was in.
So, Sam, going back to your question about how do people get sucked in, these people are very well prepared.
Sophisticated
to present what they need to present to gain the confidence of individuals so that they can move their project forward and get the investors' money.
So you actually do some due diligence, some research into the background and determine whether or not they've got a copyright or a trademark, determine if they are who they say they are, and try to establish some credibility and sort it out the difference between a potential Ponzi scheme and maybe a legitimate startup.
Sure. And you know, the due diligence that we do is the same due diligence we would help a client with in any type of venture that they were going to go in, and we give them the list of things that we would recommend they do. Whether they elect to have us do that or not is up to them, of course. But we find that even, you know, we've been talking about Ponzi schemes, but there are a lot of legitimate investments where maybe the person putting it together has had a history of difficulties in their past, or there's something in the past that might question not only... Not that they're trying to do something dishonest, but it may show that maybe their track history isn't sufficient to get this project done, which might not mean that they don't get involved, but it may require that you put different constraints on the individual as to a reporting structure or someone else that you insist that they have on their team to make sure that they do have the resources to get it done.
So this is a little different from a Ponzi. In my practice, we had a buyer who we were representing, and we were looking at potential opportunities for her to invest, and we found a deal out of New York that fit perfect. Everything about it sounded really good. Until we got to the research, and we did some research in the background of the two founders of the startup and found a history of litigations, commercial litigation, that ran from New York to California and back over a period of 20 years. First thing we did was pay for that research and back away from that deal as fast as we can. And that's some of the preventative medicine that you can provide for your clients, right?
Right. I mean, and that's part of the due diligence is looking back and finding out, And there's a number of resources out there that people can avail themselves to that we do. For example, we've worked with the Comptroller of Currency on some of these larger ones, and they're in the Department of the Treasury, And, you know, again, going back to who gets involved in these things, the Comptroller of Currency and working with them, they've told, you know, in conversations, they've said, listen, we have banks that get involved in these. We send alerts out to make sure that the, you know, the banks, to the extent that we're aware of them, that the banks, and I know that in the Madoff case, there's been reports of banks that have taken large stakes in that investment. So, you know, there are resources out there where they, you know, and I've had the individuals at the Comptroller of Currency, they say, what's the name? They say, oh, yeah, he's out of wherever. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they, yeah, they're
they
aware
know
of
the scheme. They know the whole nine yards.
Sure. They've had calls and they know people. And but the difficulty is if you're at that point and you already have your money in, it's can
little,
be difficult.
Little
you
late.
Hope that you're making that call before you put your money in because of you're getting the heads up. Again, the background, we've run into finding a lot of litigation where the case is all laid out about all these different potential claims.
So and if you're dealing with investors, whether it's a legitimate investment or whether you don't know, you're recommending that they come to you and you conduct maybe a criminal background check, credit check, do as much research as possible, just like you, maybe more than you do if you were getting married. If these are going to be potential partners, you want to know who they are before you partner up with them and write a check.
Well, first, you know, any deal someone gets involved with, that there are certain rules and regulations with regards to what the documents should contain. You know, if someone's asking you to invest in their venture, they should be they're required to provide an adequate level of disclosure for you to adequately assess the risks, and that should be contained in their disclosure documents. Commonly, it's called a private placement memorandum, and that should be the first place to look and look at the underlying documents. And then beyond that, the things we're talking about is doing some due diligence about the individuals who are standing behind or representing this venture, and it's not a significant investment to do that extra due diligence. So not only should a client not only know, again, going back to some things we've talked about in the past, is that when you're getting in a deal, how are you going to get out of it? You know, it's easy to get in, it's hard to get out sometimes. So this is all part of figuring out what's your exit strategy.
Sure.
Were some of these deals set up so there was no exit? I mean, or it was just left open?
Oh, you know, if the level of documentation that clients are sometimes provided, you know, people are generally trusting, and they feel as though that they can, you know, sign a, you know, subscription agreement, they wire it out. They're not looking at, you know, they're not even thinking about the fact that we're dealing with multiple jurisdictions. One case we were involved with, these guys had formed a country that, you know, when the internet was, you know, coming around, they felt,
hey, let's start a new country, Sam.
wait, I want to hear how they did this.
Well, I believe they called it Melchizedek, which was a,
biblical reference.
Right, it's a biblical reference, and they claimed that it was, they made a claim to some islands in the South Pacific, and also, they had a claim to part of Gaza, I believe, too. They had a website.
Pretty creative.
All these
things. Yeah, very ambitious.
And they felt the whole new world was going to be that, you know, the boundaries wouldn't matter. Well, a client investing in this type of venture needs to think, okay, if there is a dispute, you know, a legitimate dispute amongst the parties, where are we going to have
this
dispute?
What's the venue? Sure.
Right.
Who's going to resolve this thing?
And, you know, and there's still banking places in the world where money can be moved to, and it's you know, good luck getting it back to, you know, from those sources.
So you're recommending getting back to the basics on any investment that you're going to get into, whether it's stocks, bonds, business, commercial real estate, Ponzi's. Ask the question, why am I getting into this? How long am I going to own it? What really can I make on it? And how am I going to get out of it? Who am I going to sell it to? And if you can't answer those questions, maybe don't go.
Right. And if you can't, with the higher degree of risk, if you can't afford to lose the money, you better put it somewhere else.
Sure, put it somewhere.
Well, you were asking about prevention too. Isn't there one last one? And this is just talking to your friends who may have invested, because it seemed like there were so many people that said, "Oh, well, my buddy invested, so I'll invest." It was kind of how that started rolling.
Right.
What if you compared the agreements or compared the offer? Would they be the same offer?
Always get the opportunity to do that, do you, John?
Hmm.
Well, again, you know, I pause on that because, you know, some of the stuff we've seen was very unsophisticated, very, you know, the documents don't, you know, they're kind of made up documents. But, you know, with the other things we've seen where individuals are willing to go as far as to forge a diploma mm-hmm. for a PhD, those are situations where, you know, I'd like to say that, you know, a lot of times the documents just don't add up. But, you know, we're seeing that, you know, documentation is becoming more sophisticated. And the fact that a deal might change or evolve isn't maybe an indication, because deals okay. do change and evolve. But I think what you would see in most cases is that the documents don't make sense, that there's something about how the money's coming in, the rates of return, you know, that, and if you ask detailed questions about the underlying assets, they might not be able to either provide documentation or sufficiently adequate answers.
Smells bad, looks bad, might be bad.
Right, right.
I think what you're recommending, and probably what you're telling your clients, is even if it's a legitimate business deal, and if you think you know who your new partners are, let's take that research to the next step, and let's make sure we know who they are before you write that check. Is that
Absolutely.
Kind of where you're going?
Well, you want as much, you know, you want to go in with, you know, your eyes open. And many times, you know, the tendency is we're all busy. We hear a presentation. We hear kind of what we want to hear. And we all have the highest hopes it'll work out. And again, these individuals who put these things together are very trusting. And then beyond that, people who have legitimate goals and aren't intending to do anything illegal or to take people's money, even then the due diligence is good, because you understand, you know, how long am I in this deal for? How do I get out? And if there were a dispute, how would that get resolved?
So once again, this is a case where if you pay a little money up front and do a little research, a little study up front, get some good counsel up front, losing a little money is a lot better than maybe losing a lot of money. And it might prevent you from getting into a deal where you won't get your money back.
Right.
Okay, this has been a good discussion today, John, about Ponzi schemes, and maybe really coming right down to it, how to evaluate a good deal from a bad deal and how to do some due diligence to get a better chance of achieving a deal. And for our listeners, this is a huge topic and a broad topic, and if you have questions, comments about that, or would like more information about it, please go to todaysbusinessradio.com and click through to the Cameron Law Office. And John will be happy to answer your questions about this and any other questions you might have about business transactions, real estate deals, and commercial litigation. I nailed it that time, John.
You got it right, Tom.
So for Tom Lyons and my co-host, Sam Zordich, John, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Today's Business Radio with host Tom Lyons. Tom is the owner of Phelan Partners Limited, an M&A advisory and consulting firm. Today's Business Radio is also available around the clock and around the world at todaysbusinessradio.com. That's todaysbusinessradio.com. All content provided by Today's Business Radio is provided for general information only and should not be treated as a substitute for professional advice from your legal, accounting, and business advisors. Today's Business Radio is not liable for the contents of this podcast, nor does it endorse any commercial product or service mentioned or advised in this podcast. All radio shows, podcasts, and other content provided by Today's Business Radio is copyrighted and may not be reproduced or downloaded for any reason without prior written consent by Today's Business Radio. If you have a topic you'd like covered at Today's Business Radio, log on to our website at todaysbusinessradio.com and submit your comments and questions. Thanks for listening to todaysbusinessradio.com.